is that this soil really is associated with one of our signature products, the fine Yamhill County Pinot Noirs, which have gotten recognition throughout the world now, and has won a lot of awards for the vintners in Oregon. And that, it seems to me, makes this soil intriguing. But when you hear Mr. Page's story about why the term Jory soil and where it came from, I thought it really creates the third interesting reason. Jory soil, you will find, is identified with a pioneer family of this state, a family that's been here now for six generations in the state of Oregon, and one that homesteaded south of Salem, as you'll hear certainly, before Oregon became a territory. And the kind of continuity of identifying the state soil, which has already been identified by soil scientists as the one most uniquely identifying the state, and also related to a pioneer family that's been in Oregon for, I think, six generations, really struck me as making this an intriguing kind of possibility. So I'll end my testimony now and let Mr. Page briefly talk to you, if that's all right. I'll also be happy to answer any questions, but
we'll wait until
I'll answer them from ignorance rather than from knowledge, which, as you all know, I'm quite ready able to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard M. Page, and I'm here today to testify in favor of HGR 48, which was introduced at my request by Representatives Greenlick and Cameron. First, let me give you my standing in this matter. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian, as is Representative Clem on your committee. And I'm the great-grandson of James Jory, who came to Oregon in 1847, was a pioneer of 1847, and settled in the Red Hills, south of Salem. Actually, I have my grandson with me, who is a seventh-generation Oregonian at this point. In about 1832, the James Jory family emigrated from Cornwall, the parish of St. Clair in Cornwall, to New Brunswick. And then in 1836, after trying to farm the Rocky Hills of New Brunswick for a few years, they just couldn't make it. They moved to New Jersey, came down to New York and around, came up to Mississippi River to Illinois. And they farmed in Illinois for about a decade. And then in 1847, they crossed the plains to Oregon City, arriving in Oregon City just about Christmas Day of 1847. They stayed there that winter. The next spring, they came down the Willamette Valley looking for good farmland. That was the year before Oregon became a territory, even. And the Jory family, the father and four sons, there were five sons, actually, but four sons settled in the Red Hills just south of Salem, and took up donation land claims. For those of you who know the territory, it's Township 8 South, 3 West. And by the mid-1850s, under this Oregon donation land claim law, they had about 2,500 acres in that area, one of the largest holdings in the area. They're proud people. They became citizens, naturalized citizens at that time. Interesting to read some of those documents where they say, I hereby renounce all allegiance to every foreign prince, potentate, or king, and particularly to Victoria, Queen of the British Isles. It's interesting. Today, that area still contains memories. I have memories of the red dirt going out to my grandfather's prune farm in the fall when I was quite young, and probably in the 30s. But things remain today that keep the history of Jory alive. There's Jory Hill, Jory Park, Jory Creek, Jory Hill Road, and the Jory Cemetery. Well, as you can tell, I've always had an interest in family history and genealogy. Like any other Oregonian who spent a little time in Northern California, I've always had an interest in wine as well. About 5 years ago, I was on a tour of the Yamhill County wineries. One of several wineries in what is called the Red Hills of Dundee. And the tour guide was Dr. Scott Burns, who's head of the geology department at Portland State University. And that was the first time I really had become aware of Jory soil and its importance in growing grapes for the wine industry. I found that Jory soil was first identified by when it was found on a 737-foot promontory, basalt promontory in the Rosedale district just south of Salem. This promontory was Jory Hill, and it in turn had been named for the Jory family who settled there over a decade before Oregon actually became a state. Now, Jory soil has been identified on some 300,000 acres in western Oregon. It's dark reddish brown, silty clay loam. It's found in the upland areas of the Columbia basalts. That's the volcanic residue from 15 million years ago. And it's above the Willamette silt, which came later on with the Great Missoula floods. They were quite recent, some 15 to 20,000 years ago, I believe. In the early 1990s, the Oregon Association of Soil Scientists, who we'll be talking to you a little bit later, conducted research and selected Jory soil as having a special significance to and most representative of the state. The Department of Agriculture publishes a listing of state soils and is named Jory soil. Most of the other soil atlases have Jory soil named as Oregon state soil as well. Agriculture has always been important to the state of Oregon. Its natural endowments have a major benefit on the settlement of this state and on its economy. Jory soil is a namesake of a pioneer Oregon family, of which I'm proud to be a member. It's found in many areas of the state. It's important agriculturally. It's representative. And it has 14 million years of history in the state. I would urge you to seriously consider passing HGR 48 as recognizing Jory soil as Oregon's official state soil. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for our panel? No questions. You did a great job. Thank you, and thanks for bringing your grandson along.
And his grandfather.
And his grandfather. It was a great history lesson.
It was a great history lesson.
Yeah.
Just come in the back.
Oh, I'll see you. Okay.
For those who may not know, we always allow our senators and representatives to speak early because they are awfully busy around here. So, Senator George.
Be nice.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the courtesy because I'm just escaped from my committee and I need to go back. For the record, my name is State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. My district is from the city of Gaston, clear down to Monroe. So we have a lot of vineyards in that area. One of the things I'd like to relay to you was some of the communication between myself and some of the members of my district. At first, I was telling them, don't worry, it doesn't make any difference at all. And then I had a couple of them say, yes, it does make a difference if you choose a certain soil. And I suppose that is the bill we're on, right?
Yep.
All right. If you choose a certain soil to be the official state soil. And one reason for this, and I'm sure all of you are aware, is that we're tuning in and focusing on certain characteristics in Oregon wine, many of them reflected by the soil, by the elevation, by a certain part in the state, and so on. So because we have so many mixed climatic conditions, we really are producing these distinct wines. And part of the idea is that reflecting my the concern of my constituents, is that in fact by choosing Jury, we may suggest that other soils such as Willikensy, which I have on my farm, is not as good. Now, let me give you an example. Many of the soils we have that surround my farm are soils that are producing some of the finest wines, award-winning wines in the state. And it's critical that we not have anything that would appear to give a preference to one or the other, because each one of them will develop their wine based upon characteristics. My thought is we might be establishing a prejudice in favor of wine that would be grown on Jury. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? So you listed one other kind of soil. What are the, do you know the other major soils? I think we have some people.
Oh, my goodness. I have books. Or Oregon, of course, you know, if I were going to do this, I would have chosen Woodburn, which is one of the most well-known soil in the state. And Jury, I would describe as one of the more secondary lands soils, very famous soil because of for whom it was named. But the other issue, of course, is that because it is a soil that is on wine producing areas, my concern, their concern was, is that we not devalue grapes that would be grown on another soil that, in fact, whose characteristics may be as good or even superior to those grown on Jury. But yet there would be the appearance that the state has selected this as the premium soil. Now, you can see the tie may not be clear, but I'm going to tell you they convinced me that I should come in and present that as a possible opposition to the bill or consideration for the committee.
Okay. Representative Ingfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator, for sharing your concerns. Some people may not know this. Some people might. I actually have a geomorphology background, so I'm probably one of the few people up on the dais that have actually dug soil pits and tests. And so I like all soil.
Yes, personally. You love soil.
I guess we have designated the state pair.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We have as our official fruit. And I love pears, but I love lots of other. Mm-hmm. Other wonderful fruit, especially strawberries that's grown in Washington County area and Marion County. But so I guess I didn't necessarily see it as biasing against other types like the Willikensy or other soils that are also good wine-growing substrates. But I understand your concern, but I don't necessarily see, unless we're going to put a stamp on a bottle of wine that says grown on Oregon's official state soil, I don't necessarily see it as a marketing play. Maybe I shouldn't have said that and give people ideas, but I mean, I don't think it's necessarily hurt the strawberry or cherry growing or whatever. So, I certainly appreciate your concerns and. But I'm not sure how, as far as a marketing play, if it will really hurt one winery over another based on the soils that they're using.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean Fiddler, I would agree with you because I raise the state nut. Okay.
Which is my favorite.
It's not Larry. It's not
Larry. Oh, I'm glad we're on record.
Yes. That's bad as me carrying the bill recently and advocating for the bill to be killed. There is
just the hazelnut. Right?
Yeah,
the filbert.
The filbert. Yeah, we're going to all call it hazelnuts because that's what you guys wanted. But anyway, getting back to the subject, the difference is that these kind of sales niches are going to become very important because as we invite tourists to come to Oregon, we want them to be looking for that little difference in bouquet, the little difference in this. You know, we all know that we follow those kind of trends. It's what gets you the recognition for your product. And so I just hope you guys will give thought to it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we'll have Herb Huddleston and John Good. Come on up. I guess you can come together and be like. There's a microphone for each of you.
Thank you.
Hello.
I did.
just amazing.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. My name is Herb Huddleston. I'm a retired professor of soil science at Oregon State University. For some 30-odd years, I was involved in teaching and extension on the nature of soils for students of all ages around Oregon and conducted research on wet soils in Oregon as well. I want to address my remarks this afternoon in three general areas, see if I can convince you to support this bill. The first is, why do we need state soil? Second, why Jori? And finally, a note on the national significance of Jori as a choice. Why soil? We go back a little over 2,000 years to Aristotle. Aristotle identified four major natural resources. He called them earth, air, water, and fire. In today's language, that would be soil, air, water, and solar energy. Resources that are obviously essential for the sustenance of life on Earth. So I won't regale you with all the reasons and the functions of soil and why that's important. Let me just share with you, though, a couple of metaphors, quotes from people that I find particularly intriguing. The first is from a man named Nathaniel Shaler, who wrote in 1915 in a little book called Man and Earth. He writes, "Soil, ever slipping away in streams to the sea, is like a placenta that allows living things to feed upon the earth." And somewhat later in 1962, Russell Lord, in this little book called The Care of the Earth, writes, "Soil is living rock, the earthly borderline between the quick and the dead." And you want to repeat that? Think about that one. Soil is a living rock, the earthly borderline between the quick and the dead. It's kind of a neat little metaphor. So here's the problem. As you know, we've already designated in the state numerous of our natural resources. We have a state tree, we have a state bird, we have a state fish, we have state flower, and so on. All these natural resources that we have designated are easy to see, to touch, to hear, to admire, to understand. But with soils, soils are underfoot and out of sight, which makes it very difficult for the public at large to appreciate, admire, and understand the nature of this resource and the value that it has. To many people, as you probably know, the words soil and dirt are considered synonymous. But to people like John and myself, soil scientists, those are two very different things. Soil is a resource, has value, we use it, we abuse it. Dirt, however, is soil that's out of place. If it's out in your garden, it's soil. If it's on the kitchen floor, it's dirt. They're two very different things. Everybody knows, you smile, you probably heard it, that every introductory soil science course in the nation will tell the students right off, the first lecture, if you call this dirt, you're flunked. Right out. Well, I have to tell you that when I retired a little over a year ago, my students gave me this nice jacket. And printed in big orange letters right here, it says Dr. Dirt. So, but all kidding aside, one of the reasons, the main reason for estate soil really is to raise awareness and education and to use this as a symbol that enables us to better inform and educate the citizenry of Oregon at large. So that brings us then to why Jori. Why did we pick that particular soil? Back when I was considering graduate schools a number of years ago, my major professor at the time said, go to Oregon, they have a virtual museum of soils there. And of course, he's absolutely right. We have such diversity of climate, such diversity of topography, such diversity of rock types and parent materials, such diversity of vegetation resources, that the soils naturally reflect that same diversity. So we've got over 1,000 different kinds of soils, all the way from the coastal counties to southeastern Harney County to Medford and Jackson County and everywhere. There's tremendous variety and difference in soil. So how do we pick just one? How do we pick just one? And the one we pick is not intended to be a premier soil. It's intended to be a representative soil, something that can represent the value of soil resources to Oregonians and the Oregon economy. Actually, the Oregon Society of Soil Scientists, in conjunction with our colleagues in the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the university, several years ago went through this debate and the discussion of what soil should we use. And we talked about Woodburn as a possibility. Woodburn is strictly Willamette Valley soil. It doesn't represent other parts of the state as well. We talked about some nice wheat-producing soils on the Columbia Plateau, one of the best of which is a nice deep soil that produces wheat. But the trouble is its name is Walla Walla, and we didn't think we ought to have a Washington name for an Oregon soil. So after much discussion and debate, we selected Jory for a number of reasons, because it represents the greatest number of uses, particularly agricultural uses, in the state. As you already heard, Jory and its Red Hill soil relatives is a major soil in the wine-producing areas of Oregon. The hills west of Dundee is one, and other areas in the Willamette Valley. So that's a major use of this Jory soil. We go to the South Salem Hills, and we see subdivisions sprouting on these Red Hill soils. Many of those subdivisions are supported by on-site waste disposal systems, for which this is an excellent soil. We go into Benton County. Benton County is one of the major Christmas tree-producing counties in the state. Jory soil and its relatives is the basis for that industry. We go to the Silverton Hills, which are widely known for grass seed production and wheat production. In that sense, we pulled in the wheat-producing areas of eastern Oregon, having a soil that's good for wheat production. Soyuz-Law National Forest, you may know, is one of the top timber-producing forests in the nation. Those trees are growing on Jory soil and soils like that. Jory soil, as you know, has a distinctive red color, and one of the easiest places to see this on display is in the parking lot at the Enchanted Forest, just south of Salem. So we've got a great educational opportunity here. And as you've heard, Jory is tied to the history of the local family in that area. So there are a number of reasons why Jory would make a good choice for the soil. As I say, not because it's a premier soil so much, but because it represents a variety of soils in different kind of situations. Now, at the national level, about 5 years ago, maybe six, the Soil Science Society of America joined up with the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History to begin the planning for a major display on soils, which will be at the Smithsonian Institution. It is scheduled to open in June or July of 2008. As part of that display, that exhibit, each state in the nation was asked to submit a monolith, which is a board with a slice of this soil on it, to be displayed at this national display in the Smithsonian. So, and actually, Oregonians, represented by the Oregon Society of Soil Scientists and NRCS and the university, selected the Jory soil as our monolith to submit in that display. And as you've already heard, 20 states in the nation now have identified their soil with legislative action, which specifies or designates the soil as the official state soil. If we are to do that in Oregon, we would become the 21st state of that group to so designate a state soil. This little exhibit is called Soils, Worlds Underfoot, and the promotional material which I have here on the back of this magazine says, "Now's the time to tell the story of soil, to inspire, to educate, to conserve." And those are the reasons, ladies and gentlemen, that I believe we should support this resolution and designate Jory soil as our state soil. I guess we'll let John speak, and then maybe we can answer questions.
Thank you. My background, I've got a master's in soils, microbiology, and mycology. I'm past president of Oregon Soil Science Society, was on the board for probably 6 or 8 years.
Be sure and identify
we
yourself.
Own a
be sure and identify yourself for the tape. So
John Good?
Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, excuse
there
me.
You go. No problem.
And we own a local tree service landscape company in Corvallis, which we've been in business for over 25 years. And one of the things that I want to emphasize is something Herb said about Oregon being so diverse in soils. Of the 12 orders that exist worldwide, Oregon has 10 of the 12. The two we don't have is the gel soil in the tundra, frozen tundra, and the oxisols, which are in like Puerto Rico and Hawaii, what they call ironstone. So tremendous diversity in soils in Oregon. So coming back and saying what we really feel about soils, and one of the fires that we produce in our company is this soils, what they really are, trying to address urban problems in soils, and where my wife coined the term herbicide. because most of our urban environments really are basically disturbed soils. They're no longer original soils. So, but on the other hand, soils are dynamic, alive horizons consisting of mineral, air, water, macrobes, microbes, sand, silt, and clay. And it's a mixture of those things that make up all soils. Depending what that mix is going to be the classification of those soils. So just emphasizing the importance, it's not what soil we pick, but that we use this resource as an education for the entire public in general. Recently I was reading an article where a person made the comment, we're 8 inches from starvation. Well, some soil scientists wouldn't agree with that because soil, again, is a dynamic horizon. It's always changing. We've got our younger soils and septosols that haven't got any structure to them or anything. And yet the Jori soil, which is an old soil, has much structure to it. So those are kind of things that where we feel education is the critical thing on soils, not try to pick one soil. As a landscaper, we deal with landscape architects that treat a quarter mile of soil the same, plant the same trees, the same shrubs, and yet you may have 5 different soil orders in that quarter mile. Why doesn't that ash survive or that dogwood survive where the ash will? One's a wet soil, one's a hill soil with better drain. So, again, education starting from a very young age. And in closing, I'd like to read a comment. Benno Workington, who was the head of the Soil Science Department when I went there in 78, he wrote a book on footprints in the soil, or edited a book on footprints in the soil, and he said it was like herding cats. So trying to get all these people together to speak about soils. The science of ecology deals with living components, chemical, physical, and the chemical and physical features of the environment. How these interact to shape communities and ecosystems. Almost all features of terrestrial ecology are shaped directly or indirectly by the processes and organisms that are found in soil. Soils are important.
So, do you believe, from in your testimony, that Jori soil is the best representative of those soils historically and otherwise, or do you have an opinion about that?
I think historically it is, and because of the debates that we had within the Soil Science Society. Again, to finger one soil and say it's the best representative, who do you have on the committee? If it was this committee, it would probably be different than if it was a committee of beef ranchers. We're wheat growers. So to me, it's not so critical as what soil, but that we pick a soil. And the Oregon Soil Science Society, through proclamation, just because the process of trying to get to this stage even 10, 15 years ago, which we did, tried to, it's important that we just end up with a state soil.
Questions for this panel? It is always interesting to me to come to these meetings and get to learn the new things I get to learn. Okay. I have a son-in-law who's a geomorphologist, so we've had some discussions, but it is interesting to recognize, and just a matter of point, we had astronauts visit our state before the lunar landings because of exactly the same reason. There was more geology that they could study in a small place than any other place in the country. So they came to Oregon and actually visited Goose Bay, visited the Bend area. We had a lot of people who made friends with some of those people because they were taking them on visits so that geologists and others could show them all these different kinds of things so that they could have the identity later on. So I find it intriguing. And I just wanted to comment on your coat with Dr. Dirt.
Oh,
I would assume it's the same analogy as the one you made earlier, that so you as you retired you became out of place. With respect, you should still be in the classroom, and I'm sure that your enthusiasm came across, and those students were trying to tell you that, you know, they'd rather you stayed there than
they were.
So with that, no other questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. And Dale West.
First of all, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Absolutely.
I suppose I represent the wine industry here, and will probably echo some of the senator's remarks.
Your name again.
First. Dale West.
Sorry. Thank you, Dale.
Pinot Noir is the most important grape to the wine industry here in the Willamette Valley. And one of its unusual properties is that it reflects soil dramatically. As a matter of fact, Pinot Noir and the Riesling grape reflect the place where they're planted more dramatically than any other grapes. This is really well known. We produce several single vineyard Pinot Noirs. And in both Jory soil and what is sometimes termed as Willackenzie soil or sedimentary soil and various other soil types. And soil is the wine industry's lifeblood. There is no doubt about that. It's very, very important to us. Oftentimes we consider making great wine as a project that's done as a farming project more than a winemaking project. You have to get the fruit right, find the right soil, and farm it properly and take good care of that soil. You have to be a good shepherd of the earth, as it were. But the soils make distinctive impressions upon the grape. And as the senator mentioned, there's different aromas, different flavors, and even different textures, the way the wine feels in your mouth, created by different types of soil. We have vineyards in Jory soil, as I said. We also have vineyards in sedimentary soil. Yamhill County encompasses both of those soil types. The wines are amazingly different. Even amateurs can tell the difference from the soils, oftentimes in blind tastings, the way it smells or the way it feels, and find some continuity between the different soil types. So our feeling is that it would be unfair to name one soil as being more important than another. And certainly there would undoubtedly be people that might take advantage of that and say, oh, our fruit is grown in the state soil and yours is not. Representative Dingfelder mentioned that, I think somewhat in jest, but actually indeed that's almost undoubtedly going to happen. Because we deal with all the soils, we feel that they're all equal. They're just different. They characterize the wine in different ways. Certainly I appreciate the lessons in history very much. This is a commercial concern, I suppose. And placing one soil above another is definitely a big concern for us. We educate people in our tasting room all the time about soils, about the Missoula floods even, and the fact that the Northwest is such a huge basaltic plain. And we're very aware of the fact that volcanic soils are a large part of the state's history, geologically, and Washington, too, for that matter. It's so important to us. So I guess in the end, we just feel that putting one soil above another would not be quite right, but we respect them all equally.
Any questions for our staff? Well, thank you very much. And I will say that I really appreciated the article in the Statesman Journal, and I know the person who wrote that is here, and I just I think it helps to get the information out to people. And oftentimes we have opportunities when bills come forward and people don't know that they're happening, and then later on we find out there are issues at hand. And from my perspective, the thing that we want to make sure of is that we do things deliberatively. So we're going to close our hearing today on this one, and we'll probably take a little time to make our considerations, and I'll talk to members and before I make any final decisions. But I do appreciate everybody being here today. So I'm going to close our hearing on HGR 48. So I should have asked, is there anybody else here that really wanted to speak that came that didn't get a chance to? Okay, thanks. So now we're going to open a public hearing on 3068. And we'll have a short explanation from our administrator.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 3068 expands the powers and duties of vector control
district boards and county courts to include prevention or control of public health vectors and predatory animals. It allows districts to make not-for-profit application of pesticides to government homeowner associations, and allows Department of Human Services or DHS to provide matching funds for vector control in disease surveillance programs. This is a little background. A vector is defined as an organism such as a mosquito or a tick that transmits disease causing microorganisms. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And we have a panel to begin with Amanda Rich, Chris Worth, and Ron Montgomery. You want to all come up? They're very good microphones.
Well, no, that's good. None of the other, I haven't seen this sign in another hearing room.
That's good. The other thing I should mention to people, if they haven't turned their cell phones off, having them turned off is the best. And I just realized mine was not, so I will turn mine off.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I am here representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. And we have been working, actually, for the past few years with the Oregon Vector Control Association to pass an update, rewrite of ORS 452, the vector control statute. And we come to you with a bill that, as I said, we were working on over the past few years, have updated it and made some changes, had committee work groups on it from last session, and I think we've got a good, tight bill that makes some very necessary changes to statute. With me today, I have Chris Worth, who is the immediate past president of the Oregon Vector Control Association, and he's the program director for vector control with Multnomah County Health, and also Ron Montgomery, who is the current president of Oregon Vector Control Association and is the program director with West Umatilla Vector Control District. And I will now turn it over to them for the specifics and the science on this bill. So thank you, I guess. I can't remember which one of you is going to take it away first.
Chair Roblin and committee, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to discuss House Bill 3068 today. The Oregon Vector Control Association is seeking to support...
Make sure you announce your name.
That's right. I forgot that part.
No problem.
My name is Christopher Worth, and I'm from Multnomah County Health Department. So as I mentioned previously, the Oregon Vector Control Association is seeking your support for House Bill 3068. The Oregon Vector Control Association is comprised of approximately 20 agencies, which are composed of a mix of vector districts and local health departments. And as a whole, our mission supports public health through multiple strategies that include public education, prevention and surveillance of not only vectors but also their disease. Since 2004, West Nile virus has been detected in humans, horses, birds, and mosquitoes in 21 counties of Oregon. There are approximately 50 species of mosquito in Oregon, and their diversity of mosquito fauna and their individual and unique behaviors, coupled with the fact that there are approximately two-thirds of Oregon that are underserved by a local health department or vector control district providing vector services, requires various strategies to assure an effective and balanced public health response. This bill assures that constituents of Oregon that any vector work that will be done will be carried out in a consistent manner with an integrated and comprehensive approach, or an IPM. If there aren't any further questions at this time, what I'd like to do is actually go ahead and pass over the specifics of the bill for Ron Montgomery to go ahead and discuss with you.
Yep. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, again, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come back and talk about vector control in Oregon. And when we say vector control, you can automatically just think mosquitoes and rats for the most part. That's what vector control programs in Oregon deal with. My name is Ron Montgomery. I represent Umatilla County Vector Control based in Hermiston. And Vector Control has a very long and proud history in Oregon, not only providing a public health service, but also contributing to the quality of life in Oregon, in many parts of the state that would be fairly difficult to live in without mosquito suppression. So the ORS 452, which is the law that governs our operations, I don't believe it's been looked at for over 20 years. So there is some language in this bill that we believe needs to be updated. If you read through the bill, you'd see the words poisons used occasionally in chemicals, and these terms are really no longer appropriate for what we do. But I'm just going to kind of bullet these major changes that we're seeking to make. And the first one is to include the integrated pest management philosophy as a guide to vector control programs that operate under ORS 452. This has become becoming more common in the state. I believe all state agencies are mandated to use IPM in their pest control, so it only seems logical that vector control districts would follow. This is very common now for vector control districts to implement integrated mosquito control practices. But our concern is there are more and more programs being created now that West Nile virus has arrived, and we want to give those programs a very solid foundation through statute to create their program when they get started. Another issue we would like to address is the to define or give a little definition to the pesticide use plan, which is mandated to be created by these programs, but there's no real definition as to what it is. So we're asking for a little bit of guidance on what that pesticide use plan is. We're also asking to include the word vector habitat in a lot of the statute as it relates to control and eradication of vectors. A mosquito, for instance, has a flight range of 20 miles, so you could find a mosquito 20 miles from its habitat. So we want to make sure that we not only target the vector, but also the habitat. Another goal that we have with this proposal is to authorize a trustee member. These vector districts are governed by a volunteer board of trustees, just 5 citizens, and it's very difficult to get them to attend a vector control conference because they have no great motivation to go. It's very difficult to get them to go. So our colleagues in Utah came up with a very clever incentive, and what they've done in Utah is they offer their trustees up to $100 a year to attend a conference, and this really seemed to get some of their trustees to go to these conferences and to educate themselves on the vector control operations and a lot of the daily activities that relate to a trustee as he governs over the program. So we're trying to get that same sort of enticement in Oregon to get these trustees more involved in their day-to-day operations. Another proposed change is to allow the district to change their name or to have an option of how they name their district. I came to Oregon in 1989 from a mosquito control program in Florida, and everybody knew in Florida what we did because the side of the trucks would say mosquito control, but in Oregon it says vector control, and that's very confusing to the average person when you're rolling into Starbucks to get a cup of coffee and somebody sees vector control. You answer time and time again the question, what is vector control? So one of the things we'd like to do is allow the district to have some options on how they name their district, including mosquito and vector control, or just mosquito control. In the case of Umatilla County, when the election took place in 1971 to create my district, it specifically was created to control mosquitoes, and that's it. So I think mosquito control district would be very appropriate in that circumstance. One of the last proposals that we have in this bill is, I believe in 2001, there were some changes to the Department of Agriculture's licensing requirements in that public applicators could not provide pesticide applications to an area that was not adjacent to their jurisdiction. In Umatilla County, if you're familiar with that county, Hermiston and Pendleton are separated by about 30 miles of dry land. Pendleton is not in the vector control district, and Hermiston is. With the new regulations that were passed in 01, I would have to get a commercial pesticide license and provide some financial documentation in order to do vector control for the city of Pendleton or for the rest of Umatilla County, unless it was the entire county. So we're asking for a little bit of a exemption from that, and that would be at a no-profit situation, basically just to do the work at what it would cost. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions at all.
Any questions?
I just have a comment.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a comment. I want to thank you for all the hard work you guys have put into this. And it's really appreciated. I know it's been a multiple session issue, so thank you very much.
Right.
It's more of a comment. Okay. So I understand, Representative Smith, that you are a sponsor of this bill.
Yes.
Will we have to wear a mountain locator unit?
Yes.
About 10,000 feet?
I'm not going to go there.
And I wanted to say the same thing. You know, I was on the committee last time, and I know that our chair last session, Representative Smith, was actively involved in trying to get something to happen here. And, you know, I believe that we need to do more education with our people. As a kid growing up in northern Washington and a parent who came from Illinois, she was adamant about no standing water in the summer. I mean, he had to go turn stuff over, get those. You see the larvae, it's a problem. I mean, you had a responsibility to do that. And, in fact, if there was a pond that was, you know, where it shouldn't be and you started seeing the larvae, a little oil went a long way. Not saying that's a good thing, but you had to keep the oxygen away and kill the mosquitoes because it could be a real problem. And, I think we've gotten so much better at control that people start to forget that we're really only one organism away from some real problems. And the West Nile virus was one of those that people really felt was going to take over and destroy a lot of our stuff. And I think because we do have plans and we have been working at it diligently in areas where it was more likely to happen, we've had a better chance of being successful at keeping the numbers down. But I contend that, and I'm happy you're here from Multnomah County, because I think that we're having real problems in the metropolitan areas where people don't realize that the little puddle that they've kept or the container they've got outside that's got rainwater in it is breeding a whole lot of problems that could come back to haunt us. So, people who live out on farms recognize that because it's part of their livelihood to keep their animals well. People in town sometimes don't realize that they might, they start thinking, why do we have so many mosquitoes? And
I don't.
Then they look around their house and they find out there's a lot of reasons to have mosquitoes around because they left all these things out that collected rainwater and all of a sudden you got a problem. So I think it's important. And just education is important. And again, I want to thank you for your work too. So thanks. Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much. We have one other person on the list, Terry Witt from OFS.
It's close.
And do we go? I heard rats. Do we do nutria too? The bigger ones?
What do we do?
Fifth Amendment. I know.
I don't know what we
now
do.
I want to know. Now I want to know what we do about nutria since they're such a huge pest. They're like a big rat. Basically.
Yes, they are. A very large rat. They are an interesting animal. We don't have as many of them as some places, but we do have them.
We have plenty.
Yes, we do.
Wildlife viewing.
Yeah.
Afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'll be very brief. We fully support the bill that's before you. We were one of the reasons why public applicators were limited back in, I believe it was 2001, when they were in competition with private applicators doing various types of public control work. And that really put them at an unfair advantage over a commercial operator because they have public employees, public buying power, public equipment. And so in the process of trying to provide some equality, we did restrict their ability to do their vector control work on other properties. And so we worked with them this year. We started working with them the last session. And I really want to thank Ron and Chris and Amanda for their hard work in trying to find that middle ground that provided them the tools that they needed to do their job, both to control the vector and the habitat, and yet still provide some sideboards so that it wouldn't be an all-out free-for-all between commercial operators and vector control people. So I just urge your support of this bill. I think it's a great piece of work.
Any questions? Do you know if this bill would have any physical impacts? We haven't got a statement, so I was
Chair Roblin, I don't believe it does have any fiscal impacts.
That's a revenue?
Yes, yeah, so you have to do a... You haven't done a...
We haven't got the request back yet.
Oh.
But I think we're okay on this one, personally. I can't imagine that it would.
If it would, it would be at the local level.
Exactly.
I would
That's
believe
right.
Right. At the county level who's implementing it.
Yep.
They're all agreeing.
Okay. They would know.
Yeah, they know.
Okay, any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
So... We'll close our public hearing on 3068, and we'll open a work session on 3068.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll move House Bill 3068 to the floor with a good pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 3068 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have our assistant take roll.
Representative Boquist?
Excused.
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Excused.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Chair Robles?
Aye. So the bill passes, and we'll move it to the floor.
Do you want consent calendar?
I think this is probably a consent calendar.
Unless somebody really wants to.
What do you think?
Yeah.
We'll have, we're going to have Representative Smith carry this bill.
That's what you get
on second thought.
I'm going to make a motion quickly for a consent calendar.
It doesn't matter. No, I'll be glad to carry it. I think we need to carry it since we worked on it 2 days.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'll keep it short.
Okay. It is a good bill. Should pass.
Yes. We'll try not to pester you.
Okay, great.
So we'll close our work session on 3068. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3365, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair. This House Bill 3365 would prohibit Fish and Wildlife Commission from adopting a rule that bans the use of telescopic sights with a muzzle-loading firearm to hunt game mammals during the controlled muzzle-loader-only season. And that's it, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. I wonder if Representative Witt was going to be here. I don't know. Do you want to have somebody?
You want me to have him call?
Yeah.
He's probably in committee. Can we call?
Probably is.
Well, we can send someone down.
Ask Representative Klem to fill us in.
Or Representative Klem.
Representative Smith.
We will check on see if Representative Witt wants to be here. And in the meantime, we'll start out with Al Elkins and Joe Ricker of OHA.
Against it.
Oh, there he is.
Oh, wait.
There
hold
he
on.
Is.
We'll wait a second, and we'll let Representative Witt. We were just going to get you. So you want to take a breath while we're letting you come up? It's fine, too.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Good Chairman, afternoon. Members of the committee. Brad Witt, State Representative, House District 31. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon and for sending someone out to round me up. I certainly appreciate that. I have sponsored House Bill 3365 at the request of one of my constituents. His family has several members who are visually challenged significantly, and the bill is an attempt to allow he and similarly situated individuals who enjoy muzzleloader hunting to be able to do so with the aid of a telescopic sight, not limited just to the visually impaired, but to everyone. This is a bill that hopefully should not adversely impact our state's wildlife population at the ranges that muzzleloaders are effective. This bill should not allow any kind of significant advantage for those who are using those kinds of sites. As it stands today, Oregon is one of about a quarter of the states that disallow these kinds of sights on the weapons. In fact, there are 14 states that that disallow these kinds of sights, 36 that that do provide for them. And with that, Mr. Chairman, a fairly simple, straightforward bill, and would be happy to try and answer any questions that someone might have.
Any questions?
Yes, Representative. I have one, and I apologize, Representative, if this seems really obvious, but your statement about that using a telescopic sight would not give an advantage.
The distance is... Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, for the visually impaired, it may make the difference between whether they're able to hunt or not. For those who are not, the relative distance of muzzleloaders and their effective range is such that a telescopic sight probably does not provide a very significant advantage over open sights or other types of iron sights.
Currently, it's my understanding that if you wanted to put a sight on a muzzleloading gun, that's fine, but you would not be able to do the special hunts that are available or other hunts. Is that your understanding?
My understanding, Mr. Chairman, is that they are disallowed in their entirety. If you choose to use one, you can use one in the regular rifle seasons.
Right.
That would be the only time that you could. So, I guess I'm now understanding better, Mr. Chairman, the nature of your question. Those hunts that are reserved strictly as muzzleloader hunts disallow that. So if you wanted to hunt in a regular hunting season, my understanding is that, yes, you can.
And so this bill specifically is to those special sessions that are open to muzzleloading as well?
For the muzzleloader hunts, yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. That's what I just want to make.
Right? Yes, yes. Sorry for the confusion. I missed your question.
No, it's okay. Any other questions?
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
So next we have Al Elkins and Joe from Oregon Hunters Association.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3365. The representative gave you a good overview of what the bill does. I'm sorry to say that the Oregon Hunters Association is not in support of this bill. We have a policy that we adopted not too long ago regarding muzzleloaders. And our policy basically states that for the purpose of this document, any legal muzzleloader as of 10/31/06 will be called a traditional muzzleloader. With any addition of modern technology, such as, but not limited to, scopes, fiber optic, or laser lights, closed ignition, non-granulated, or any propellant other than black powder, it will be called a modern muzzleloader. The Oregon Hunters Association views the traditional and modern muzzleloaders as two types of muzzleloaders. In the event that the state of Oregon deems it legal to use any muzzleloader other than a traditional muzzleloader, the Oregon Hunters Association shall request the state of Oregon preserve the status of the traditional muzzleloader hunts when considering seasons, tags, and draws. A modern muzzleloader shall be allowed only when centerfire weapons are legal. We developed this policy based on a survey that we did in, we believe it was 99 or 2000. We certified 1,000 members, and 1,000 members returned their surveys. And 2-1, they were saying that this was the policy that should be adopted, that no scopes would be allowed during the traditional hunts that you talked about earlier, Mr. Chair. Testimony later that you'll hear from ODF&W talks also about a survey they did with a very high percentage of actual muzzle loader tag holders that also agree that scopes should not be used so during those traditional hunts. So that's where we are, and with me today is Joe Ricker, a member of the board, an OHA, and he'd be glad to answer any questions that that the committee might have on this topic.
Any questions that we have? I guess what I'd say is, all right, Joe, do you use a muzzle loading? Do you do this kind of hunting?
No, I'm not a muzzle loader at this time. Have never loaded with muzzle loading.
Identify yourself, too. I'm sorry.
I'm Joe Ricker. I'm Midwest Director, Oregon Hunters Association. I do not hunt with a muzzle loader.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clem.
When is muzzle loader season? Before general?
It's at a different time earlier in the year, and then there's some late season as well. It's spread out. It's a different time than the center fire rifle. And there's a couple of reasons for that. It gives the person who prefers to hunt with the traditional muzzle loader has a better opportunity, especially those before the regular season, and he's not in competition with the longer range firearms.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the point about no scopes is, you know, you're going to get in at times when there's more deer, but you're going to be using a weapon that can't go as far, and this is another limitation to try and compensate. You know, you get in early, but you don't have as good of weapon in terms of likelihood of success. The interesting thing is just this issue of, it's almost like this bill doesn't even deal with that problem. It's almost like the issue is sort of a disability issue more than really, you know, for everybody, and you know, there's some questions probably around eyesight and hunting and other things that would need to be talked about if you're going to go down that road. Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Roy Ellinger, and is Roy here? I didn't see Roy. So Ron Anglin from ODF&W.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Roy had to step out and sends his apologies. The bill before you this afternoon, as has already been stated, does provide the ability for people that are hunting during the controlled muzzleloader seasons to use a telescopic sight during those seasons. The muzzleloader seasons that we have today were at request of hunters that wanted to have primitive weapon hunts during certain times of the year, and the department has responded to those requests and the demand for increased opportunity. Today we have about 35 total muzzleloader only seasons, and there's about 4,000 tags scattered between those three seasons for antelope, or the three types of seasons for antelope, deer, and elk. The department has really studied the technology issue with muzzleloaders pretty extensively. In the late 90s, we did a very comprehensive public survey of muzzleloader hunters themselves and had about 4,600 people that took part in that survey. And of those people that responded, 3% believe that scope should not be used during the primitive weapon seasons. And I think it's important to note that this is something that the commission typically deals with as part of their normal regulation-setting process, that they do look at public requests and consider those, and have had or have made changes to accommodate technology in the past. In reference to muzzle loaders, they specifically have been a little bit reluctant to do that, primarily because they feel that the technological advances that have occurred with muzzle loaders, that if you increase the opportunity to be successful, that it would result in a larger harvest, and that the commission, based on department recommendations, would cut back on opportunity. And hunters have said that for these primitive weapon seasons, they do not want to see a reduction in opportunity. And the question did come up on whether there's something that should be addressed relative to visually impaired. There is currently a statute that has been adopted that identifies visually impaired hunters. It is 498-170, and specifically it talks about visually impaired hunter means a person who files proof with the commission that their visual acuity does not exceed 2200 in the better eye with the best correction, or that the person's visual acuity, if better than 2200, is limited in the field of vision by no more than 20 degrees. So the legislature has already addressed that in the 90s relative to visually impaired hunters. And I think what this bill is trying to get at is most of us, as we age, have problems with eyesight, and dealing with that and open sights, it does put a hunter at a disadvantage. And we have had requests, our commission has had requests to accommodate that, and has chosen up to this point in time not to do that. Thank you, Chair Roblin.
Thank you. Any questions? I would ask the question about the statute that allows for. Would that, because there is a statute that does address visual problems, would it allow a person to use a muzzleloader with a sight during the muzzleloading season?
Chair Roblin, if they met the terms as outlined within the statute, they can, right now it is still prohibited, but they can petition the commission to request special accommodation.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Representative McPherson.
This maybe connects into some other subject matter we've been hearing, Mr. Chair. But Mr. Anglin, I get the sense that because of the sort of general decline in interest in hunting, at least among Oregonians, although it sounds like maybe there are more people coming in from out of state, that that we at least foresee a time when we wouldn't be able to manage our wildlife populations effectively by issuance of tags. And I'm wondering if this the situation of preserve, whether we need to accommodate greater efficiency to achieve the management of the wildlife populations involved through expanding the use of this kind of technology.
Chair Roblin, Representative McPherson, certainly if we had an abundance of wildlife and current regulations were not being successful in reaching our management objectives, we would look to loosen technology. You see many of the eastern states and midwestern states where they don't allow the use of centerfire rifles, as an example, do allow telescopic sights on muzzle loaders. They're one of the primary weapons used, along with bows and shotguns with slugs. But some of those states have no limitation on the number of deer that you can shoot in a season. They're overrun with white-tailed deer, and they're looking for any way possible to reduce the numbers. In Oregon, on our controlled hunts, we currently have an oversubscription of people applying for these controlled hunts. As an example, for the popular controlled muzzleloader elk seasons, it takes anywhere from 2 to 3 years to draw those tags. So there is a great deal of people that want to participate in these primitive weapon hunts and are applying for those on an annual basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing that, thank you very much. I will close our public hearing on 3365. That's what we had it listed for. So, but I also want to open up a work session on House Bill 3068 and entertain. Ask well, first I have to suspend the rules. I need a concurrence.
I'll make a motion to suspend the rules and let Representative McPherson vote on House Bill 3068.
Is there any objection? Sure. Seeing none, that passes, and we will move on to a vote on 3068. Representative McPherson, how do you
vote? I vote aye on House Bill 3068.
Thank you very much.
I'll further that motion.
So we will close our work session on 3068. And is there anyone here that has any other questions for the committee? Seeing none, we will close our committee on Ag and Natural Resources. Thank you very much for all being here.